Well, how does one define an idol? Well, I suppose a lot of possible definitions come to mind, but if you think about it, all the things that people have worshipped, whether the stars of the heavens or the other heavenly bodies, what they were worshipping was something that God created, and God had declared it very good, and man took it and corrupted it and used it for some other purpose than that for which God had created it. Or you take some tree or some stone or other object that is part of creation, and man takes that which was to the glory of God and corrupts it and turns it into an idol. And so what we have here today is the Bible. It was created by God. It is very good. And it is something that testifies to the glory of God just as much as all the rest of God's created works. And just as surely, we can take it and corrupt it and make it into an idol. And that's one of the most difficult things about studying the Bible and being a part of a tradition. My whole upbringing was, you know, book, chapter, and verse. And what does the Bible say? And studying the Bible constantly, and the focus of all the assemblies I've ever been a part of have been studying the text or hearing a sermon that is supposed to be based upon the Word of God. And yet how easy it can be to take those understandings of Scripture and make them into an idol, and that we are so certain about what the Bible says about something that we will not consider anything else. Well, there's something to be said for certainty and not being people that are, like Paul says in Ephesians chapter 4, like children blown every which a direction by whichever way the wind is carrying them. But on the other hand, there's something to be said for humility as well. And so it's a sobering thought. And what we're going to be doing today and next week is returning to our series on Ezekiel, of all things. And we're actually skipping over the section of Ezekiel and his oracles against the foreign nations. We may come back and talk about that some other time. But we're going to basically pick up in chapter 34. And the whole remainder of the book is of a different kind of character, a much more positive, hopeful kind of outlook that we're going to see that Ezekiel has for us. So I'm putting the marriage series on hold for a little bit. Some of our people that might benefit from that are not here. I was taking the Johnson girls to the airport yesterday, and Andrew went with me, and I... question came up. He said, "Are you preaching tomorrow?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, what on?" And I said, "Well, I'm not going to do the marriage series. I'm going to do something else." And so, "What do you think I ought to preach on?" He said, "Well, I think you need a lesson on how parents ought to love their children." So we'll see if we can make some application from here today. But I'm actually going to do Ezekiel. There may have been some ulterior motive involved in his recommendation, but I do exhort you as parents, love your children, certainly. Let's think a little bit about Ezekiel chapter 34 through the end of the book, chapter 48. And here we see that just as in the earlier section, there were just scads and scads of oracles of doom and judgment against Judah, and very few statements of hope sprinkled throughout. Now we find things flipped. In the latter part of the book, it's all pretty much hope and the restoration of God's people with only a sprinkling of a few statements of judgment throughout. And that is because of the very nature of Ezekiel's ministry and the historical circumstances under which he labored. And of course, the significant event that happened that changed everything was the destruction of the city of Jerusalem and the temple in 586. And that before that event happened, the burden of Ezekiel's ministry was to try to get through to these kind of thick-headed people that they were not acceptable to God. He was not blessing them. They had a false sense of security rooted in their idolatry of the Word of God. And that idolatry was particularly derived from the fact that there were four things about the Bible they were absolutely certain about. And you couldn't convince them otherwise. God had made a covenant with Abraham. God had given them the land of Canaan. God had made a covenant with David, and God had established his temple in Jerusalem. Now, you can't particularly say that any one of those four things was wrong. They were right to know that God had made covenants with Abraham and with David and given them the land and this temple. But it's really what they made of it that was the problem. And so it's very similar to what we've been seeing in the book of Job that Grant's been leading us through a study of. A lot of what Job's friends say is typical kind of wisdom teaching that you see in Proverbs or in Psalms and so on. And you can't disagree with it. But it's the application that becomes the real rub. And so when you take God's promise to Abraham and you take that as something of an entitlement, that the promise to David is something to be taken for granted, that the temple meant that, here's a place that is absolutely inviolate. God would never allow the Gentiles to come and to destroy the city or the temple. You have another thing coming, because that's the very thing God was going to do. And just as you see throughout the Bible, when people put their trust in something other than God, the very focus of God's judgment is to take that thing away from them. And so you put your trust in your king, I'll take away your king. You put your trust in the land, I'll take away the land. You put your trust in the temple, I will take away the temple. And on it goes. And so what we find is that after the destruction of the city of Jerusalem and the temple, clearly people have realized, yes, God in fact can take away your king because he's been carried off into captivity. And the people are deported out of the land into exile, and the temple has been absolutely burned to the ground. And that was probably the most telling symbol of all that finally clued in the people that no matter how blind or deaf they were, they finally at least had to acknowledge, well, that did happen. I mean, there wasn't anyone roaming the streets of Jerusalem saying, what, burn the temple down? What are you talking about? It's standing right over there. No, it wasn't. They weren't that deluded. And so as a consequence, what happens? Well, the people get pretty bitter and cynical. And a lot of them are concluding God doesn't keep his promises. You can't trust him. I mean, he promised that we were going to have this place and so on. And, well, you see what's happened. And so Ezekiel is put in a very unusual kind of position where up until the destruction of Jerusalem, he's trying to undermine their false sense of security, trying to destroy this false hope that they have in not false promises. The promises were true, but their false application and understanding of those promises. And now after the destruction of the temple, they're having to, Ezekiel's trying to teach them, now the promises are still true, but you have to understand what they really mean and rebuild their confidence in the Lord and their trust in those promises. And so again, it really has to do with their relationship with God, and in particular, is this relationship with God to be seen as an unconditional privilege that you can take for granted? Well, obviously not. That kind of thinking is what got them into trouble to begin with. It is not unconditional. It is not, a privilege that you can enjoy regardless of, who God is and what your relationship is with him. And rather, instead, you ought to look at it this way, that God's covenant with you is an invitation for you to enter into this relationship in gratitude and in submission to his authority and his will and what is pleasing to him. And so, I wouldn't want to be Ezekiel for a lot of reasons, but the daunting task you have of trying to undermine people's confidence in the wrong thing, rebuild their confidence in the right thing, and get them to understand the subtle nuance or difference there is between those things. How is it they were wrong in trusting in the promises of God earlier, but now that's exactly what they need to do to get things right again? And so the real problem, of course, is the nation is like Humpty Dumpty, all the king's horses, all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. That's really the message of Ezekiel. Just like when Jesus told the disciples, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. They say, well, who then can be saved? That's not possible. And Jesus didn't say, oh, you misunderstood me. He said, yeah, that's right. It is impossible. But what is impossible with man is possible with God. And so what all the king's horses and all the king's men could not do, God can do. And he will put Humpty Dumpty back together again, so to speak. The nation will be restored. The nation will be fixed. And so it is this great message of hope that the rest of the book of Ezekiel is looking forward to. And so some of the things that we will see in this section are very typical, very common of what we see among the prophets of the Old Testament. It's to be expected if they were all speaking for God and they're all on the board with the same message of God and the same plan and purpose that God has. You would expect that in some ways there would be some similarity in their message. And so when you look at their restoration oracles, they share a number of things in common. So one of the common emphases is the whole house of Israel is going to be restored. And sometimes this is particularly emphasized that even the northern kingdom of Israel that had divided off and been carried off into Assyrian captivity and pretty much wasn't even heard from again, even they will be brought back. And Israel and Judah will be reunited, and the whole of God's people are going to be restored. There will be the renewal of the relationship between God and his people. I will be their God, and they will be my people. That statement of the covenant relationship that God has. Coming back to the land is an essential feature of that. Just as being deported into exile was the punishment for their violation of the covenant, they'll be restored to the land, and also the Davidic line will be reconstituted. And again, I think this is probably the single most difficult thing that the prophets had to deal with. Of all of the promises God had made, this one seems the most difficult. And perhaps none more challenging than that of Jeremiah in Jeremiah chapter 22, when he said explicitly, this man Kaniah, who was the last king of Judah, really. His uncle Zedekiah kind of tended things and oversaw the last years of the demise of Judah while he was off in captivity. But this Jehoiakim, or Jeconiah, or Kaniah, as he's known by those three different names, Jeremiah said he will not reign upon the throne any longer, and neither will any of his offspring. None of his descendants will prosper upon the throne of David. And very clearly what he was saying is the line of David is cut off. There will be no more kings. And you're like, well, wait a minute. How is that consistent with God's promise to David? Because God had even acknowledged in his promise to David, now sometimes one of David's descendants might sin and I will chastise him. And they could even envision maybe the chastisement would be somewhat severe. But I will not cut him off like I did Saul before you, David. So how do you harmonize this? Okay, we understood we might sin and we might be punished by God. But how does that translate into cutting off the line of David altogether? And I think Jeremiah starts to give us some answer to that, because immediately following that oracle in Jeremiah chapter 23, he talks about how God will raise up a righteous branch for David. And the imagery seems to be that even when you cut a tree down and the tree appears to be dead and there's no sign of life from that stump for years and years and years, there is still hope that old tree stump may sprout one day and a new tree grow from it. And that's what happens with this promise to David. And so the New Testament understands Jesus is the righteous branch of David. He's the root of Jesse. He is the rightful king. Now, he's a descendant of Coniah, so how can he sit on David's throne and prosper? Well, I think we understand his kingdom is not like David's kingdom. His throne is not a literal geopolitical king's throne. but he reigns in a spiritual kingdom. And that difference is significant enough to mean that Jeremiah's prophecy was true. The political line of David was cut off, never to be renewed ever again. But God's ultimate promise was not about a political line, it was about a spiritual kingdom. And that part of the promise remained. And so we come to chapter 34 of Ezekiel, which is, I think, placed here for a reason. There's some rationale as to why it occurs in the spot that it does. And what basically chapter 34 is about is not delivering the people from mean old Babylon, and that one day I'm going to bring you back to the promised land. That's not your real problem. Now, that's one of the problems, and Ezekiel will get around to talking about bringing the people back to the land. That's one of the typical fourfold things that the prophets spoke of when they talked about Israel's restoration. But here in Ezekiel 34, that's not where Ezekiel begins. Oh, your problem is you're in Babylon. Your problem is you're in Gentile captivity in a pagan land. No, that's not the problem. And as you look at it, Ezekiel chapter 34, you might say, well, your problem is you got bad leaders, bad shepherds that are not taking care of the flock the way they're supposed to, abusing the flock in ways they're not supposed to. But even that's not the focus of Ezekiel chapter 34. Those things are true. Those things are mentioned. But that's not your real problem either. The real problem is that God needs to be restored in your minds as your true king and shepherd. And only once you have God in his proper place, God has taken his place as shepherd of Israel once again, will all of the other things make sense. That we will understand once God is king and we are honoring him and acknowledging him as king, then all the other aspects of the restoration will follow. God as king will bring us back to our land, and he will reestablish the line of David, and he will cause us to dwell securely and be protected from our enemies and things of that nature. And so, what we look at in the remainder of the book, just to kind of give you a kind of a heads up of where this is going, this is kind of Ezekiel's version of the gospel, the good news. And of course, chapters 40 through 48 is that peculiar kind of visionary picture of a restored temple, you know, that of course is, temple's been destroyed, so this would have been something very keen in the imagination of the people. And it may seem very strange to us. A lot of people look at that as kind of a blueprint for actually rebuilding a third temple in Jerusalem, again, in the millennial reign of Christ, we're going to have another actual literal temple built, just like Jesus is going to be literally sitting on a throne in Jerusalem. But that really is something else altogether, and that's why I describe that section as envisioning the good news. It is a graphic visual portrayal of the same kind of message that is being conveyed in more standard prophetic terms in chapters 34 through 39. And it all has to do with restoration, and so restoring the role of Yahweh as the shepherd of his people, and then restoring the land, Yahweh's honor, his people, his covenant, and his supremacy by conquering all the nations of the earth. That is what the section concludes with there. And so we're looking at chapter 34 this morning as this kind of keynote point of who God is as the true shepherd of God's people. And basically, the chapter falls into three parts. There is the announcement of the deliverance God is bringing to his people in the first 10 verses. Then the nature of that deliverance, what exactly it is they are being delivered from in verses 11 through 22. And then the goal of that deliverance is this covenant of peace as it is described at the end of the chapter. So I just want to read through this chapter and make some observations as we look at some of the highlights of this. And so notice the first six verses do bring up the bad shepherds that have been not taking care of God's flock. And so here's the indictment that the prophet announces against them. The following message of Yahweh came to me, human, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say to them, O shepherds, thus has the Lord Yahweh declared, hey, shepherds of Israel, who have been tending themselves alone, surely it is the flock that shepherds ought to tend. The milk you consume, the wool you wear, the fatlings you butcher, that the flock you do not tend, the weak you've not strengthened, the sick you've not healed, the injured you've not bound up, the stray you have not fetched, the lost you have not sought. With harshness and ruthlessness you have mistreated them. They have been scattered for want of a shepherd. They have become prey for every wild animal. My flock wander about among all the mountains on every high hill. My flock have been scattered over the entire face of the earth with no one to search and no one to look for them. Well, we have a section here very similar to Jeremiah chapter 23, which, again, interestingly follows immediately on the heels of that statement that the king, Kaniah, would not prosper on his throne any longer, and none of his descendants would sit upon his throne. And then it turns immediately talking about these bad shepherds, but he's going to raise up this righteous branch of David. And what is a much shorter section in Jeremiah has now been expanded to this much longer chapter in Ezekiel. And it's very similar, a lot of the same kind of ideas, bad shepherds not taking care of God's flock, God's going to shepherd them, appoint a new and good shepherd over the people. Well, the imagery of shepherding is not, of course, foreign to us, even though a lot of us may not have firsthand experience with sheep. We know the 23rd Psalm, the Lord is my shepherd. It seems like Jacob is the first one that mentions the idea of God being a shepherd as he's blessing his sons there at the end of his life. In Genesis chapter 48, you know, he mentions the fact that God has always been a shepherd and taken care of him. And the idea of human beings being shepherds, we recognize when Joshua was being selected as a replacement for Moses in Numbers chapter 27. The idea was that someone needs to be selected who will shepherd Israel, and they will go out and find pasture and come in and find safety under his leadership. And in times where they've had bad leaders, like you might remember during the time of King Ahab, the prophet Micaiah says in 1 Kings chapter 22, he saw all Israel like sheep without a shepherd scattered. And so that's kind of the picture that we have here. The bad human shepherds who have not led the people well, and the people have suffered as a result. Well, who are these shepherds? Are they just anybody in a position of leadership? The priests, the prophets, the elders of the people, the kings of Israel certainly would be included in that. Well, I think that Ezekiel chapter 34, God is talking about the kings of Israel in particular for a couple of reasons. When you get down to verses 16 through 19, there are the rams and the bucks of the goats that do represent the aristocracy, the, you know, fat cats we would call them, but that's changing the animal imagery a little bit. And they push their fellow sheep around and, you know, get their way and so on by being stronger and bullying. But they're different from the shepherd, see? And so I think the king is the shepherd, and then the aristocracy are these kind of, you know, rams acting like bullies and so on. And, of course, at the end, it is David who's going to be appointed as one king, one shepherd over the people. And so I think we ought to think of the shepherds as being the kings in particular, who have been pathetic and doing a horrible job. And, of course, they had a lot of help doing a horrible job. But the responsibility really falls upon the last of the kings of Judah. And, you know, it's interesting how they are indicted here. Verse 3, you're eating their milk and wearing their wool and butchering the fatted sheep. And you read that and you go like, well, is that a problem? I mean, if I kept sheep and I wanted to milk them and, you know, eat the cheese I made from their milk, or wear the wool fleece I took off of them, or butcher one in a while to eat, there's nothing particularly immoral about that. We'd consider that acceptable. Well, this is a case of where analogies kind of break down. We are not talking about literal sheep and the kind of relationship an actual shepherd has with his sheep. There's a reason you keep sheep. You know, they do produce milk. They do produce wool. They are to be eaten. But when you're talking about actual people, for the king to be fleecing his people, for the king to be consuming the fruit of the labors of his people, for a king to be butchering his people, that's a different thing altogether. And so it's just a reminder that the analogy is not exact. It is not as if the king were truly a shepherd over sheep. He is a human being who is supposed to administer God's justice among fellow human beings. And so then, those are the evil things that the king is doing. Verse 4 is a series of things that ought to be done but are not being done. And it ends with saying that they've been treated with harshness and ruthlessness. And so the sheep are scattered. But, you know, as terrible as that sounds, it's like, considering the kind of shepherds they've had, heading for the hills and taking your chances with the wolves, you're better off. You know, I mean, with shepherds like these, who needs wolves? You're facing certain death and destruction at the hand of your shepherd. At least run to the hills and hope for the best. Maybe you'll escape the predators that are out there. But God has a better solution, which is he will gather them and to take care of them. So, in verses 7 through 10, God then announces his sentence. Therefore, O shepherds, hear the word of Yahweh. As I live, the declaration of the Lord Yahweh, surely... And he doesn't even finish what he's saying. It's almost as if the Lord just exasperated with the situation, how disgusted he is with how his people have been treated. He never finishes what he start out saying, and so he starts over. Because my flock has become spoil, and my flock has become prey for every wild animal, for one of a shepherd, and my shepherds have not searched for my flock, and the shepherds have tended themselves instead of tending my flock. Therefore, O shepherds, hear the word of Yahweh. Thus has the Lord Yahweh declared, look, I am against the shepherds. I will hold them responsible for my flock and terminate their tending my flock. The shepherds will not tend themselves any longer. I will rescue my flock from their jaws, so they will no longer be prey for them. And you'll notice there's something missing from this as an oracle of judgment against the shepherds. God really doesn't say much at all about them. You know, I'm going to hurl you into a foreign land, or I'm going to butcher you like you've butchered them, or I'm going to fleece you like you fleece them. You don't get anything like that, just a statement, I'm against you, I'm done with that, you're being fired. And that's all the Lord really has to say to these bad shepherds. Because the focus isn't on, oh, they're bad shepherds. The focus is on, I will take my place as shepherd of my people, and I'm going to take care of them. And that's the emphasis that you see that begins developing here. And so notice how the tone of this, which has already started to change in verse 10, continues now to be the emphasis in verses 11 through 16. How is the Lord going to take care of them? How is he going to deliver them from the power of these bad shepherds and so on? Well, notice verses 11 through 16 focus on a lot of these external kinds of threats that the sheep face. The imagery being, you know, here's a predatory animal or starvation or something like that. For thus has the Lord Yahweh declared, here I am. I will seek the welfare of my flock and examine them carefully, just as a shepherd examines his herd. When he is present among his scattered flock, so I will examine my flock. I will rescue them from all the places where they've been scattered on a day of dark clouds. I will lead them out from the peoples, gather them from the countries, bring them to their own land. I will tend them on the mountains of Israel, in the valleys, in all the inhabited places of the land, in lush meadows. I will tend them, and on the lofty mountains of Israel will be their pasture. There they will lie down in lush pasture and feed on rich meadows on the mountains of Israel. I myself will tend my flock, and I myself will let them lie down. The declaration of the Lord Yahweh. The lost I will seek, the strays I will fetch, the injured I will bind up, the sick I will strengthen. And you'll notice that he has reversed everything that verse 4 was talking about, all the things that the bad shepherds were not doing. And now in reverse order, the Lord is reversing this, and he will seek the lost and fetch the strays and bind up the injured and take care of the sick and strengthen them. But the fat and the healthy ones, now what is the Lord going to do to them? Well, here's one of those translation things. A lot of the Hebrew text, as it has traditionally come down, says, I will destroy them. And the old Greek translation of the Old Testament, a lot of the other versions say that I will guard them. And so you say, well, which one of these makes sense here? The fat and the healthy ones. Now, who is that? Well, he's talking here about the sheep, the fat sheep, the healthy sheep. And these are the same ones we're going to be talking about in verses 17 and following. And so if they're stated that they're being destroyed, then there really doesn't seem to be much point to verses 17 through 22. And since it's possible that it's just one letter difference, an R and a D look almost exactly alike and are easily confused, and so the word destroy versus the word guard, it seems a very compelling case to say he's not going to destroy them, but he is going to guard them. But then the question becomes, in what sense is he going to guard them? Not protecting them, but rather policing them, watching them. You know, and so you think about watching somebody. You might watch somebody in a protective kind of way, but you might watch them because you're suspicious. You know, that guy's shoplifting, I'm going to keep an eye on him. And I think that's what the Lord's saying here. He's putting the fat and healthy on notice. I'm watching you, and I'm going to keep you constrained by the rules. I'm going to administer justice among you and make sure you behave yourself in the way you treat the other sheep. And that's really the focus again of this next section. And so here the Lord not only delivers the sheep from the external threats, but also the internal threats from your fellow sheep. So now as for you, my sheep, thus says the Lord Yahweh declared, look, I will judge between one sheep and another, that is between the rams and the bucks. And so here you've got the aggressive male sheep and the aggressive goats, male goats. And you have to keep in mind that in the language of the Old Testament, you know, sheep weren't always just sheep the way we think of it. They distinguished between large livestock like cattle and small livestock like sheep and goats. And so a shepherd was a shepherd of both sheep and goats. And, of course, there are places in the Bible that talk about distinguishing the righteous and the wicked as sheep and goats. But in other places, the sheep and the goats are just considered the, you know, part of God's flock. And but here are the most aggressive, dominant rams and bucks. And God's going to judge them. God is going to, again, administer that justice that he talked about in verse 16. Is it not enough for you to feed on the lush pasture that you must trample the rest of your pastures with your feet? Is it not enough for you to drink the clear water that you must foul that which is left with your feet? Meanwhile, my flock must feed on what your feet have trampled and drink what your feet have fouled. And so you get a picture again of this, you know, big sheep who pushes in to eat what he wants and drink what he wants, and he's so selfish and unconcerned about the other sheep that, you know, they just got to eat, you know, grass that he's been walking on with his dirty feet and drink water that's been fouled with his dirty feet. Therefore, thus says the Lord Yahweh declared to them, look, I myself will judge between the fat and the scrawny sheep, because you throw your weight around with flank and shoulder. You butt all the weak with your horns until you've scattered them abroad. Therefore, I will rescue my flock. They will no longer be prey, and I will judge between one sheep and another. And so, again, the extent of God's security and protection isn't just from some external threat that comes in. The wolf isn't the only thing the sheep has to be concerned about. But what if you got some bigger, mean, strong sheep who's in the pen with you? Well, God's going to protect you from those kind as well in this restored leadership and shepherding by God as the true shepherd of his people. And that brings us then down to the end, in which he announces then, kind of extraordinarily, verses 23 and 24, I will appoint a single shepherd over them to tend them, my servant David. And he will tend them and be their shepherd. Then I, Yahweh, will be their God, and my servant David will be ruler among them. I am Yahweh, I have spoken. And that just strikes me like a thunderbolt out of the blue, because reading Ezekiel 34 up to this point, the last thing you would expect that God would say is, I'm going to appoint another human shepherd over my people. Because you've definitely got the impression he was saying, this is not working, these shepherds are bad, I'm going to do it myself. That's the only way it's going to get done right. And God has emphasized, I will look for them, I will seek the lost, I will bind up the injured, I will strengthen the sick, I myself will be shepherd of my own flock. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to appoint David shepherd. And you just scratch your head and you say, well, why David? And of course, by Ezekiel's day, David's been dead for 400 years. Is God speaking of literally bringing back David from the dead and making him shepherd? Well, probably most of the people understood, because of the promise to David, it is the seed of David, this descendant of David, that God is going to raise up to be a true shepherd over God's people. And that, of course, is clearly the fulfillment that is intended. And there are only two other places in the Bible that speak that way. You know, like we mentioned, Jeremiah 23 says there's going to be a righteous branch of David. You know, and there are several passages that talk about what relates to David. But there are only two prophets that actually said David. And that was Hosea, who spoke again of the people returning to David, and Jeremiah in Jeremiah chapter 30. So you got these three passages that actually don't say of David or related to David, but David himself is going to be the shepherd of God's people. And so, again, it must have been something you wonder, well, how does God emphasize he's going to be the shepherd, but then turn around and say David is going to be the shepherd? But when the New Testament comes along, of course, it becomes abundantly clear, because Jesus is both God and man. He is the Son of God. He is the Son of David. And you see that very emphasis being made, for example, at the beginning of the book of Romans. Jesus is declared to be the Son of God by the resurrection from the dead, and he is also declared to be the Son of David. And so he is both. And so how could this David be shepherd of God's sheep, but also it's God himself? Well, Jesus himself is the seed of David, who is God. But it's also understanding the background of this passage that makes Jesus' use of the good shepherd imagery in John chapter 10 really take on its meaning. You know, we read John chapter 10 and it's kind of a nice little metaphor. Jesus is the good shepherd. He cares about his sheep. But that's not at all how it would have been heard by the people of Jesus' day. Knowing passages like Jeremiah chapter 23 and Ezekiel chapter 34, when Jesus says, everybody who came before me are thieves and robbers, who's he talking about? He's talking about the leadership of Israel. And it's an indictment of these people. And they figured that out, and they were upset, you know. But that's not the worst of it. When he says, I am the shepherd, in the context of Ezekiel chapter 34, you are claiming to be God. And they understood that too. Because that story of the good shepherd continues on throughout the 10th chapter. And part of that is, as he says in verse 30, I and the Father are one. And they took up stones to kill him because he was blaspheming, making himself to be God. Now that's exactly what he was claiming to be. He was claiming to be the fulfillment of everything that Ezekiel was talking about here in Ezekiel chapter 34. Now you think about all the applications you can make, kind of these principles here. You know, people running for political office and how political leadership ought to be servants of the people rather than serving themselves. They truly ought to be public servants. But that phrase is almost a joke, you know, because they don't serve the public, they serve themselves so often. It's typical human nature. And I doubt we will ever find a perfect governmental system or a perfect human leader to place our trust in. And that's one of the great warnings we ought to have. You shouldn't look to a political party to deliver you. You shouldn't look to a politician to deliver you. We shouldn't get caught up into thinking that there's one particular candidate out there who's going to save America. You know, God is the one that's ultimately in charge, and God will raise up and cast down people and nations according to His purpose. Now, we ought to vote, and we ought to exercise our privileges as best as we can. We ought to certainly pray about what's going on and do what we can to be an influence for good in our country. But our true trust must be in God. And men will let us down, and we shouldn't really be too surprised by that. But God will never let us down. And so we long for a better government. We long for better laws. We long for better justice. And we will get that someday. But not here. Not in America. Not in Africa. Not anywhere else on the planet. We'll get it in heaven, ultimately, where the perfect fulfillment of this will be experienced, where the perfect shepherding of God will take place. And that's where the very final part of this comes into play. It's really a picture of heaven, ultimately. I will make a covenant of peace for them. That's what the goal of God's covenant has been from the very beginning, that we might dwell in peace, that we might be whole, lacking nothing. And that's what Psalm 23 is about. The Lord is my shepherd. I don't lack for anything. I am whole. I am complete. I find my full satisfaction in God. That's why we have a covenant of peace. I will eliminate vicious animals from the land so they may dwell securely in the desert, sleep in the forest. I will make them and the environs about my hill a blessing. I will send down the shower in its season. There will be showers of blessing. The trees of the field will yield their fruit. The land will yield its produce. And then they will live securely on their land, and they will know that I am Yahweh when I break the bars of their yoke and rescue them from the power of those who enslave them. And they will no longer be spoil for the nations, nor will the wild animals devour them. They will dwell securely with no one terrorizing them. And I will provide them with a peaceful plantation, and no more will there be victims of famine in the land, or they will suffer the derision of the nations. They will know that I am Yahweh their God with them, and that they, the house of Israel, are my people, the declaration of the Lord Yahweh. There's a little bit of repetition here where there's kind of three things he emphasizes. There's peace with the animals, even, that we won't worry about predators. There is the blessing of the vegetation, that the land produces its fruit and produce, and so we have nothing to fear from starvation and want. And we are delivered from all oppression of any enemies that might afflict us. And it's not enough for him to say that once. He goes through that cycle once, and then he repeats it again. And so if you notice, it seems like he's repeating himself. Well, he is. But that's how emphatic this is, that God, with his covenant, will bring true peace and deliverance to us. And so he concludes then, climactically, verse 31, you are my flock. You are the human flock of my pasture, and I am your God. And so what a marvelous statement that we can be God's people and of his flock and to have such a shepherd. And when you read this in Ezekiel chapter 34, it's really a very moving kind of picture of God as shepherd of his people. That he's a God who cares about his flock, and he is going to take care of them. And this vision that he has of a perfect place of paradise, of perfect peace, that we will have without any threat from the outside, any threat from the inside, any threat of want or neglect. But the picture becomes even more robust, of course, in the New Testament, because as Jesus says, he is the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. And there's another analogy that doesn't make any sense. Because if you've got a flock of sheep and a wolf is coming or a pack of wolves are coming, and you go out and get yourself killed, now the sheep have no protection at all. Well, what good's that going to do any of the sheep? Now, a shepherd might risk his life to fight off the wolves and the predators, because if his sheep all get taken, he's not going to have anything anyway, and that's a pretty desperate situation. So he takes the risk, but he certainly doesn't want to die. He knows that would be fatal for all of them. But here again is where the analogy, even though it breaks down, becomes a very profound point, because it is precisely in dying that this shepherd will save his sheep. Because what threatens us is not an external predator like a wolf. What threatens us is our own sin. And the only way that could be redeemed and we could be delivered from that is by his sacrifice. And so, as touching as Psalm 23 is, as Ezekiel chapter 34 is of God as a shepherd and how he loves his sheep and cares for his sheep, the picture we get in the New Testament is of a shepherd who became one of the sheep and gave himself and sacrificed himself for us. And that's such a much more powerful picture, because it shows not one of these bully kind of rams pushing his weight around, you know, being one of the sheep like that. Not a shepherd ruling over his flock like a tyrant, but one who would sacrifice himself. And he went before us, and he suffered for us, and he went through all what we have gone through. And there is a shepherd who has proven himself that he loves us and cares for us. And so we have no reason to doubt his promise that he will bring justice, and he will bring peace, and he will deliver us from everything that afflicts us. But that will be in the end, when everything is made right. And so we might want to say, well, why doesn't the shepherd do all that now? Why did God just wave his magic shepherd's rod and make the world a perfect place? And the answer to that, I think, again, as Peter would say in 2 Peter chapter 3, God is not willing that any should perish, that all will make room for repentance. And if it were simply a matter of forcing the sheep to do something, God could do that. But since it's a relationship in which we must choose to trust and love God, the only power that God has to persuade the hearts of men is the sacrificial example of Christ. And as the gospel is proclaimed, and as people have the opportunity to hear the message and think about what a shepherd we have and the promises that he has made, that they are given the free choice to decide for themselves, will they follow this Jesus? Will they recognize him as their shepherd? Will they hear his voice and follow him? Or will he be a stranger to them, and they just simply cannot hear, and they will not follow? If you will, take your song and turn to the number that, 428. I thought he might pull that. I said, you know, when Adam finds out what I'm preaching on today, he's going to feel bad. He changed that song from the shepherd song. So if you want to turn to 428, he wants to use that as our invitation song, which speaks of the Lord as our shepherd, and what a fitting conclusion that will be. And as always, if there is some way we can be of help, there is no time like the present, and if you would like to come and let us know what it is we can do to help you in particular this morning, while we stand and sing the song.